This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program. This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Welcome to another edition of Global Warming Corner on Radioactive Magazine on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is your host, Dave Mitchell, and we will be discussing the development of industrial agriculture in the United States following World War II with our guest, Craig Volland. Craig has a degree in civil engineering, and for the last 25 years, he has been researching the food industry. He is the chair of the Kansas Sierra Club Agriculture Committee and was one of the founders of the Kansas City Food Circle. I learned from an independent party that Craig was going to give a talk on industrial agriculture at the All Souls Unitarian Church on January 24 at 10 a.m., and subsequently invited him on the show to talk about this critically important subject. Craig, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay. As I understand the information that you provided me and from our conversations, there was a very conscious decision by the U.S. government after World War II to industrialize agriculture, that the intent was to take advantage of overseas markets, that there were millions of small farms in the U.S. that were regarded as a massive misallocation of resources that were viewed as better utilized for the manufacturing and service sectors, and that there were certain wartime industries available to be applied for civilian use. Can you expand on these themes?
Right. Well, what you've just said is classical economic dogma. And incidentally, I went to business school, too, so that's why I recognize what really occurred after World War II. After all the destruction, the U.S. was really on top of the world because we avoided, as far as developed countries are concerned, we avoided all that destruction.
Yeah, there was a lot of massive destruction around the world, particularly in Europe and Japan.
Right,
and,
but we didn't. Japan. So we were calling the shots, and so we were pretty much looking at, in classical economic theory, international trade is based on a comparative advantage. Is that you're supposed to make or grow what you are best able to do. Like we had the vast Great Plains and the Midwest, which were nearly ideal agricultural areas. So, of course, the economists had the ear of the politicians in Washington said, well, our comparative advantage is growing food, so we're going to feed the world. And we've been listening to that now for some 70 years, that we're going to feed the world. Well, in order to do that, when you have to ship so much stuff such large distances, you need to be the low-cost producer. And that's the key from the economic standpoint of how industrial agriculture came about, because they applied factory engineering principles to living things, whether that's plants or animals, to be the low-cost producer in the world. Uh-huh. And that's how they still think to this day. Mm-hmm. And that's how it got started. Well, the other major element to this was the availability of new technologies that were developed for warfare. For the First World War, it was organochlorine chemistry, which was used for war gases, and then after that was eventually developed into the DDT and other chlorine-based pesticides. And during the Great Depression in the 30s, Hitler wanted to develop nerve gases, so that's how we ended up with organophosphate-type chemistry The guy who invented that in Germany realized during the war that they would kill insects. And so that's how we ended up after the war. And the final thing was that that for the war effort, the United States needed munitions. And so they developed a technology that's very energy intensive along the Tennessee River, the TVA power plants, for the production of fertilizer. Straight from the air, essentially, they would develop urea and ammonium from ammonia from the air in the process. It's very energy intensive.
Yeah, I think my understanding is from talking with you that these industries, these wartime industries, which were, I think, primarily they'd been involved in the creation of explosives and other, well, I'm not sure exactly what else, but there was these industries were there and they could be turned to civilian use in right. The form of, I think, nitrogen compounds and phosphorus, right?
Yeah, the big picture there is, though, I think, that instead of these people started out after World War II to remake our economy and our agriculture, and their way of thinking was not working with nature like had been done previously to try to have healthy soils and other methods by which you use nature to help you grow food effectively. Their idea was to fight nature. Mm-hmm. They wanted to kill the weeds. They wanted to kill the insects. Mm-hmm. They wanted to cram all these animals into small spaces and run them like a factory. Mm-hmm. So it's a mentality that is really closely akin to the military.
Yeah, that's truly scary, actually, in the long run. I think, I know one of the things we talked about was we talked about the idea of, or in your outline, you talk about creation of a value-added food system. And we talked about how what we do is that instead of selling corn or soy directly to the population, you grow a lot. Much of your corn and soy crop goes to the creation of beef, which then is sold to the domestic and overseas markets for a much higher profit.
That's right. It's called dollar value added agriculture, where you can make a whole lot more money using this corn and soybeans and wheat to a certain extent. And run them through animals and sell the meat instead of the inputs. So that was the kind of thinking. That's what gave birth to the what we now call CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, or what I call animal factories. That was the thinking behind that. We didn't really want people just to eat corn because you can't make much money off that. So we wanted to eat lots of meat. And right after World War II, the livestock associations got together with the USDA, and they did a massive propaganda campaign on the American people to convince them that there should be a slab of meat on every plate every day.
Uh-huh.
And when I was a kid, that wasn't the case. We went to grandma's on Sunday and maybe had a roast. And during the week, we didn't have all this meat. But then 20 years later, I know with my mom, she started serving slabs of meat all the time.
Uh-huh.
And that's how it happened. It didn't happen because really people wanted it. It's because they were propagandized that that's what was healthy for them.
Yeah. Well, I know things are beginning to change to a certain extent. There is an article in in Reuters called published in December of 2011, called "Where's the Beef? U.S. Beef Consumption in Decline," and it notes that U.S. beef consumption has declined 13%. In the last decade, and per capita consumption in 2011 is 25% less per capita than in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, the American diet is changing. But My understanding is that the beef industry is compensating by shipping beef overseas.
That's right. They still have, because meat in developing countries is seen as a status symbol in many respects, particularly in China, that they started eating more meat, and so that has compensated somewhat for the loss of the meat sales in the United States. The other thing is, people are taking, and this is really important, that people are beginning to take their own health in their own hands. There's a reason why they're suspicious of what they hear about what they should be eating, because there's usually some corporate PR firm behind the curtain that's trying to sell them something, some processed food full of sugar and fat, just like earlier on they were convinced to eat more and more meat. And people are not healthy in many instances. Even though our mortality rates have gone down some since World War II, there's a lot more chronic disease like diabetes, which is directly connected to all this, essentially all this processed corn, the stuff that isn't fed to animals, is ground up and made into all these products that are put in the processed foods.
Right. Right. Well, I know that in the process of growing all this corn and all the soybeans, which can you give us an idea of the percent of our corn crop and soybean crop that go into constant CAFO operations, and then address yourself to the reality, address yourself to the fact that there's a lot of greenhouse gas emissions created in this process.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. If you exclude the corn now going into ethanol production, and the corn that is exported, of what's left used in the United States, three-quarters of it is fed to animals in these CAFOs. And the number for soybeans is about 60%.
Well, yeah, when you told me that, that just blew my mind that amount of that has to be a massive amount of corn and soybeans.
Right, and if you think of if you've driven through Iowa, that's the best place to do this, or Illinois too. You'll just, as far as the eye can see, you'll see corn, and then maybe soybeans, mainly corn. And all of that takes huge amounts of fossil fuels to run the tractors, to harvest it, then ship it to the feed mills, which in many cases are halfway across the country. A lot of the feed also comes from Argentina and Brazil, too, shipped in and shiploads. So there's a huge amount of transportation and processing of fuel requirements.
Just to create feed for these CAFO animals, primarily, I would assume it's primarily cattle and pigs.
Chickens is the biggest one.
Are chickens the biggest?
And that's a good point, too. The other thing is, as we said earlier, dollar value added agriculture. It's you make more money putting these grains through animals. But one of the reasons that there's so many greenhouse gases is that the efficiency of this feed in producing meat is very low. For example, at least the ratio of the conversion ratio of feed to meat in a cow is like 4 to 1 or more, meaning that only 25% of that feed actually turns into the animal. Mm-hmm. That number is 33% in pigs and 50% in chickens. So it's, chickens are more efficient.
Uh-huh.
But still, all of that stuff that isn't turned into meat is waste.
So that's like 4 pounds of feed for cattle produces
one pound of
meat.
Three pounds of feed for 1 pound of pork.
And then 2 pounds of feed for 1 pound of chicken.
Correct,
So chicken is your best bet as far as greenhouse gases go. But as far as CAFOs go and beef goes, I think we were talking a little bit earlier that a Wikipedia article that I read indicated that livestock operations worldwide produce 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions annually.
Sounds about right. Yeah,
and,
it's huge.
Very
it's more
high
than all transportation. I think I read that it's more than all automobiles and airplanes, I think.
In the world?
I believe so. That's most of the rest is electricity. But No, it's a huge thing, and it really doesn't receive the attention that it deserves.
Well,
the source.
It certainly doesn't. I mean, you know, I know at least it's not my perception within environmental circles that that agriculture gets talked about very much at all. And
well, it really should, because it's really tough, because just like we started out talking about how we're going to feed the world, that is a paradigm idea that started 70 years ago that is almost as powerful today among official circles. The livestock associations are probably, along with pharmaceuticals, the most powerful lobbying forces in America. So it's very difficult to get any change at the governmental level. That's why the Kansas City Food Circle was created, is that we're going to educate one person at a time about healthy eating and environmentally sustainable eating. And we're making real progress, but we're still small compared to the total. But it is, in my opinion, unrealistic. And this is why a lot of the big environmental groups don't try it, because it's such a tough pull to get any change out of the federal government because of Congress.
Well, is it safe to assume that the U.S. cannot feed the world? Is that a safe assumption?
I don't think we can in the long term, because it is so energy intensive. And secondly, if you really look at it, occurred to me one day that this, why should we feed the world? Why don't we teach the world to feed themselves?
Yeah.
That is an old idea, and it's a perfectly valid one. So I think I don't think that we can feed the world, or that we should feed the world. We should worry about feeding ourselves. Okay. Sustainably.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the negative environmental impacts of CAFOs in particular. I mean, there's the anaerobic lagoons.
Yes.
Excuse me. Where they manage their millions of tons of
right.
manure waste.
Yeah, just to give you the comparison of, let's say, raising your animals free range on a pasture. They eat grass, or they, in the case of pigs, they may grub for insects and stuff in the soil. And then their waste goes right back on the pasture to fertilize grass. And it breaks down mostly aerobically, meaning with the air, which does not generate methane. But when you cram 50,000 pigs in one section of land like they do in western Kansas, and then you have like 10 of these huge lagoons, typically 6 to 10 acres each, when that waste goes in there, it's all anaerobic. And that chemical reaction creates methane. Along, it also breaks down the organic nitrogen, and you get ammonia. And these two gases, anhydrogen sulfide, which is very dangerous, they all go up in the air. And in the case of methane, it is one of the more powerful greenhouse gases. So these big pig factories are generating enormous amounts of greenhouse gases.
Okay. Well, and beef CAFOs as well, and I know that animal digestion accounts for a significant percentage of methane gases produced from CAFOs.
Yeah, the ungulates, their stomach system generates that. But I don't know. I haven't actually seen any studies on this lately. But in my opinion, the other part of the problem is that cows did not evolve to eat corn and soybeans. They evolved to eat grass.
Grasses, yeah.
So that's how their stomachs evolved to process. And so I think there is some methane coming out of these grass-fed beef, but I think it's far more when you're forcing these animals. They've even done studies and found that the animals' stomachs are inflamed and also cultivate some very dangerous E. coli bacteria for that reason. So.
Well, which leads to the other subject we talked a fair amount about, which was the high use of antibiotics in these animals and these CAFOs.
Yeah, so when you cram tens of thousands of pigs in small spaces, Actually, pigs anatomically are very much like humans. If you cram them in the small spaces, they're going to die if they because of disease transmission. And it's a continuing and always has been tremendous problem for the industry, and they don't learn their lesson. Instead, they try to make up for it by putting in all these antibiotics in the feed primarily, but also the water. And chickens, too, and they put it in the water for chickens mostly.
Well, and the danger is that antibiotics become become
resistant.
Much better, much more highly resistant to
antibiotics. Right, and some of the antibiotics that they're using, still using in these pig factories, are very important antibiotics for humans, and there's no rule by the FDA that's going to prevent their continued use. So they have not even come close to solving the problem yet of feeding too much antibiotics to farm animals.
Well, and that's scary in the long run, because the more they use these antibiotics, the much greater chance that there will be some bacteria strain out there that becomes completely resistant to any antibiotic that we have at the moment at this time.
Right. There's a newer disease called MRSA, methicillin resistant staphylococcus, MRSA, which you've probably heard about. That they have even found it in the neighbors of these farms, that when they spray this wastewater, sometimes they pump the wastewater out of these lagoons and spread it on crops, and they have found a correlation of community-acquired MRSA with how close you are to one of these CAFOs. So it's actually spreading out into communities from these CAFOs.
Well, I think, that gets us back to the lagoons again. And there's all sorts of issues with poisoning of the water table and right. streams and rivers from those lagoons as well.
Yeah, CAFOs is the largest single source of bacteria and E. coli into our streams in America. There's been a study on that. Yeah, and just to remind people what CAFOs stands for, that's concentrated animal feeding operations. Or perhaps I should start using the word animal factories, because that's what I think is a better term for it.
Uh-huh. So. Right. Okay, just a little public announcement here. You are listening to another edition of Global Warming Corner on Radioactive Magazine, and we are talking with Mr. Craig Volland on the subject of industrial agriculture. One of the issues with CAFOs, and then I will seek to leave the subject, is the issue of animal cruelty.
Correct. Yeah, so they're inherently, these folks who invented this bizarre technology were not thinking much about what was happening to these animals, all of which are sentient beings, and particularly the worst cases are pigs, and in particular the mother pigs or sows, that are kept on in these metal crates, and they can't even turn around their whole lives. And there's been a huge outcry about that over the last 20 years, to the point where some of the end users, the grocery chains and restaurants, are saying they're no longer going to accept pork from these animal factories that use that process. Mm-hmm. The other worst case are the egg-laying hens, where they would cram six or eight of these hens into these cages where they could hardly move. And what they found out when they did that was they would pick each other all the time. So what's their solution? Well, they cut off their beaks. I mean, that's the way they think. This is an industrial mindset. Mm-hmm. They don't even think in terms of they're dealing with animals that are alive.
A living organism that has awareness, and they have an existence, and they have feelings.
Right.
And it's just, it's a barbaric, from where I'm standing, it's a very barbaric thing to do.
Oh,
and it's all at the god of profit.
Exactly. I do think that the cattle feedlots, they're outdoors, but if you go out to western Kansas, where they're all over the place, when it's 110 degrees, they give them no shade. And in the winter, the fascinating thing is there'll be this huge pile of manure because they don't actually remove the manure until they ship the animals out. So they just pile it up. And the cows would stand on top of the piles of manure. And I said, well, why are they doing that? And he says, well, they're trying to keep warm. Well, that breaking down that's keeping them warm is also generating methane gas, greenhouse gases too. But so it's a bizarre system, and that's why we want to, well, in my opinion, in order to get rid of CAFOs, everybody's going to have to eat less meat to do that, and it needs to be free range.
Yeah, Craig, could you expand on that idea of free range and bring in the idea of organic food?
Right. Personally, I don't think the U.S. government or the state governments is really going to do anything about industrial agriculture. It's really going to be up to us to eat healthy for our own sake. And in my opinion, that's local, organic, and free range. That is the three principles that we need to keep in mind. Organic, no chemicals, free range, the animals. If you do eat meat, I'm fine with people who don't want to eat meat. More and more people are saying, well, why should I eat meat and torture animals? So personally, I think free range is better. So it's local, organic, and free range, and this is going to be solved when everybody out there decides they want to take their health into their own hands.
Well, that's the hopefully the market. I know the market is moving in that direction, and I know that in our conversation you said something about how organic foods are about 10% of the total agricultural production right now.
It's probably less than that. But
less than 10.
It's growing 10 or 15% a year, though. People, you hear lots of propaganda against it, and people understand that what you're hearing is mainly from some PR firm of some big corporation that is frightened about organic because they realize that it's against their paradigm of industrial food production.
Okay. So I think at this point in time, it's very key that people recognize that their meat comes from CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding organizations, and they need to significantly cut their consumption of beef for sure.
Well, and pork and chicken too.
And pork and chicken, and seek to get their meat sources from free range
right
sources as opposed to the other sources. I think that there's also the issue of nutrition and taste of food.
Right. When industrial agriculture increased their yield so much of corn and soybeans and so on, what they really increased was the weight. That's all they cared about because they're selling by the pound. And so they just added carbohydrates and water. There's a great book out there called The Dorito Effect that I read a few months ago that goes into that. That a lot of these so-called, this green revolution, basically diluted the flavor and nutrition. And so that's why they're trying to put the flavor back into it in processed foods to make it taste good. Well, that's not really very smart. If you want to be healthy, you go out and get your own local organic vegetables and as much as possible make your own food.
Well, Craig, we could obviously talk about this subject for quite some period of time, but we're out of time for today. And thank you very much for being on the show. And maybe maybe we could get together and continue the discussion further.
That would be great.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.
This week on the Heartland Labor Forum. In the 1950s, St. Louis labor leaders Harold Gibbons and Ernest Callaway championed a new kind of labor movement embracing workers as total persons fighting for justice as workers and citizens. The alliance of this interracial duo of Teamsters has profound relevance for today. We'll talk to Robert Bussell about his new book on them. Then, how does community policing work in Kansas City? We talk to two inspiring cops. Thursday at 6 p.m., broadcast Friday, 5 a.m.